18th at 7 p.m. If you are an Art Theater member, you can get in for free. For all current dates and times, you can go to www.arttheater.coop/full-schedule. Today's Disability Beat is sponsored by our community partner, Jet's Pizza. Jet's uses only premium ingredients, including dough made fresh daily. Jet's Pizza stores are located at 512 South Neal Street in Champaign. Their number 217-352-3333 and 1907 West Springfield Avenue. Their number 217-352-9992. You can order online at jetspizza.com. Disability Beat is also sponsored in part by attorney Baku Patel of Patel Law, who practices Social Security disability law and represents those who have been denied benefits. There are no fees unless Patel Law wins your case. You can contact Patel Law at 217-384-1111 for a free consultation to discuss your Social Security disability case. Patel Law is located at 108 West University Avenue in Urbana, with offices in Danville and Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is Lynn Watson from Champaign County Head Start. You're listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Susan Frick, who leads an effort to support individuals and families dealing with younger onset Alzheimer's. But first, disability news for the week of May 16, 2016, from Disability Scoop and Inclusion Daily Express. A group of leaders in disability rights joined together at a press conference last week to call on Governor Bruce Rauner and Illinois lawmakers to close 6 out of 7 state-operated institutions by 2020. The plan entails transitioning almost 1,700 people with disabilities currently living in state institutions into a community of their choice closer to family and friends. In addition to community integration offering people an improved quality of life, the Going Home Coalition says the cost to operate state institutions is costing taxpayers $429 million each year, nearly 5 times the cost of community integration. Illinois institutionalizes more people with disabilities than almost any other state in the nation. The Illinois Council on Developmental Disabilities has developed Illinois at the Tipping Point Blueprint for Redesign in Illinois that focuses on bringing Illinois in line with the national trend and reducing our state's reliance on institutions and improving access to community living opportunities. Barb Pritchard, co-founder of Community for All Coalition, said, quote, "The cost of institutionalization has gone up $10,000 per person since last year, but the toll on the individuals forced to live in these facilities is far more significant. More than 90% of states have reduced the institution population for people with disabilities, and 14 states and the District of Columbia have closed all facilities. It's time for Illinois to step up and protect the interest of taxpayers and people with disabilities," end quote. Federal education officials are reminding state and school districts that states and school districts that they have an obligation to provide special education services to kids with disabilities, even if they live in institutional settings. In a letter sent recently, the U.S. Department of Education said that states and schools must ensure that they identify children with disabilities and provide them the services they are legally entitled to under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Ruth Ryder is the acting director of the Education Department's Special Education Office, and Michael Uden, who recently left his role as assistant secretary with the agency, wrote the correspondence. In the letter, they stated, quote, "The Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services is issuing this letter to clarify that children with disabilities residing in nursing homes and their parents have the same rights under IDEA that apply to all other eligible children," end quote. A 2014 report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office found that nearly 5,000 school-aged children lived in nursing homes nationwide. Such kids are among the most medically complex, with about 40% needing a feeding tube and a third relying on oxygen therapy to breathe. The report described many as nonverbal and minimally responsive. States are responsible for locating children living in nursing facilities and ensuring that either the school district where the parent or the child resides is providing services, the Education Department guidance indicates. Importantly, Uden and Ryder said that schools cannot refuse to evaluate a child simply because they are unable to go to a school setting for such an assessment. And just like any other student with a disability, those living in nursing homes should have an individualized education program designed to meet their needs. Wrote the Education Department officials, quote, "We understand that children residing in nursing homes may not be able to attend the school they would attend if not placed in the nursing home. However, in these situations, the public agency still must ensure that children with disabilities residing in nursing homes are educated in the least restrictive environment appropriate to the child's needs based on his or her individualized education plan," end quote. One of the nation's largest home improvement retailers will pay millions to settle claims that it fired thousands of workers with disabilities in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Lowe's has agreed to pay $8.6 million to resolve allegations brought on by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that the retail, quote, "engaged in a pattern and practice of discrimination against those with disabilities." According to the EEOC lawsuit, Lowe's terminated and did not provide reasonable accommodations to employees with disabilities if their medical leaves of absence exceeded the company's maximum leave policy. Lowe's allegedly fired workers regarded as having disabilities or associated with those who did, the suit claimed. Under the agreement, Lowe's will retain an ADA consultant to provide employee training, revise policies, and develop a system to track accommodation requests. In addition, the $8.6 million agreed to will be distributed to affected former employees. Said EEOC General Counsel David Lopez, quote, "This settlement sends a clear message to employers that policies that limit the amount of leave may violate the ADA when they call for the automatic firing of employees with a disability after they reach a rigid, inflexible leave limit. We hope that our efforts here will encourage employers to voluntarily comply with the ADA," end quote. And finally, a mobile application that helps crack down on vehicles illegally parked in wheelchair-accessible spots is gaining momentum. Mac Marsh, who uses a wheelchair after a spinal cord injury, created the Parking Mobility app, which documents illegally parked vehicles, then sends the information to law enforcement. Marsh said, quote, "It's a really simple way to report violations by simply taking 3 photographs and walking away," end quote. But Marsh points out fines aren't the end goal. He said, quote, "They can take an online education course. They can then pay a reduced fee to the county. And the important thing here is that they learn about the rules, they learn about the laws, and they learn not to do it again," end quote. And that's the news for this week. There's an app for that. There's a cure you You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined on the phone today by Susan Frick. Susan is one of the few people in the country who is knowledgeable about and supportive of people who are struggling with younger onset Alzheimer's. Rush Hospital is where her work is centered, and she's here to tell us a little bit about what she does and what we should know about this disability. So welcome to the program, Susan. Susan, are you there? Okay. Well, Susan, if you can hear me, and if you are able to call in again, please do so, and we'll get you on the air as soon as we can. In the meantime, let's talk about some of the things that I know about the program, and hopefully she'll get back on. Susan is a social worker who works for Rush Hospital in Chicago, and they run a support group called Without Warning. And this is a program that is only for people with early onset or younger onset Alzheimer's, as well as people who are family members. And when we were talking before the program, Susan was telling me a little bit about the program, that it really is the only one in the country of its kind. Most people who are familiar with Alzheimer's, and I think those of us who have older family members, grandparents and parents who are getting into their 70s, 80s and 90s, have experienced this kind of dementia. But there are those folks out there who are younger and have that onset much younger in their age, even as early as the age of 40, somewhere between 40 and 50 years old. Some of you may be familiar with the movie Still Alice, which Susan will be talking about, which gives some information about, from one person's perspective, what that disability is like and how it impacts families and children. So, interesting that Illinois houses the only program of its kind in the country that does that, and the support group has been very important for families who are affected by that. As Susan was telling me, there are people who come from other states to participate in the Without Warning group, and it's very, very critical for those families, and so we hope that we are able to get that information from Susan today. All right, so in order to make some progress in this area, I'm going to try and get her back on the phone. So for just a moment, I'm going to put on some other music and give myself a moment to contact her and see if we can work out this problem.
Black don't man. but little girls will understand. When everybody's trying to sleep, I'm somewhere making my midnight creep. In the morning, the rooster crows, something tell me I got to go. But I ain't a backdoor man, yeah. But I am people, backdoor man. Well, the men don't know, but the little girls, they understand.
Alrighty, I believe we have Susan on the line. Thanks
Hi.
For calling in, Susan. We missed you there for a few minutes. I'm not sure what happened, but I'm glad you're on. So I talked a little bit about you and the program, but why don't you introduce yourself and talk somewhat about the program that you're running and the issues that people with younger onset Alzheimer's and their families deal with that are different from those who are elderly who have that disability.
Sure. And I work through the Rush Alzheimer's Disease Center, which is one of federally funded Alzheimer's centers. There's about 29 throughout the country. And for now 12 years, we've been running the support group called Without Warning, because we were seeing through our clinic more and more people who were young. And by young, we mean under the age of 65 when diagnosed. Because typically when you think about Alzheimer's, you think, you know, someone in their 85 years of age. But there are people who get it, you know, there's been people in their 30s, 40s, most often young onset is 50s and 60s, but can be younger also. And so we started up this group, and it has just grown considerably in the years that we've had it going. And now we're averaging around 80 people coming to a meeting, which are both people with young onset and family members. And, you know, just as you can imagine, it's just different. It's not that the Alzheimer's is different, but the people are just a different point in their life, and there can still be children in the home. The person can still be working, you know, and so there can just be so many different types of stresses put on the family when it happens at a younger age.
80 people, that is a bunch. I mean, I've been involved in lots of support groups, but my gosh, I think the most I've ever seen at a support group meeting has been like 25.
Right. And typical support group meetings should be, you know, I come from a social work background, and should be like 8 to 12 people. So when we have 80, what we're doing is breaking into 8 different groups at the same time. So it's not that all 80 are in one room together. And so we have 3 different groups for people with Alzheimer's disease, and then 5 different groups for family members, kind of based on where they are in the journey of the disease.
What is the prevalence of younger onset Alzheimer's?
You know, we haven't been, I'd say, as professionals, very good at trying to figure out how many people there are with younger onset. And for years, we didn't even really have programming or services geared towards people who are younger. Now I would say there's more programs, smaller programs, not as large as Without Warning, cropping up. But you can hear the number of about 10% of those diagnosed with Alzheimer's are young, but that takes in also other types of dementia.
Mm.
So typically what I hear is that it's around 4 to 5% of people diagnosed.
Which still seems rather high.
It's still high, and it's still obviously a lot of people considering the growth that we've had in you know, the 12 years we've been going. So, you know, there's, and I think as the baby boomers are aging, we're going to be seeing more and more people with Alzheimer's and more people with young onset. And so we need programs out there, and we need services and awareness, because I think this is a really isolating experience to have Alzheimer's, but in particular younger onset, can be just a very kind of lonely and isolating experience for the whole family. to go through it.
So talk a little bit about that experience and some of the examples of folks that have been helped by this group and by the programs at Rush.
Sure. You know, it's just Alzheimer's can make you feel different and make you feel like you don't quite fit in. And I think, you know, I've sure seen it at any age. People can become a little more withdrawn, a little more out of their community. You know, I think it's different though when you're talking to someone who's 85 and has other health issues and has a community that's also going through the similar thing at that age. When you're talking about someone in their 50s or 40s, or we've had two people in their 30s and without warning, they don't have a peer group that's going through this also in their community. It's very rare for them to be able to find somebody else who's going through young onset on their own. So I think that's one reason this program has done so well, is because it provides a space for the person with Alzheimer's and for family members and the adult children and young children to be able to know that they're not alone and that there's other people going through this with them. It doesn't make the journey, it's the same journey. They're still going, you know, having to deal with the same things, but they at least know that there's other people who are going through it with them and understand what they're going through.
Right. So when you are offering this program to people, do you find that it's mostly the people who are experiencing the younger onset Alzheimer's who are attending, or is it families, or is it a combination?
Yeah, it's really a combination. If you look solely at the numbers, we have more family members coming. But at some point, for people with Alzheimer's, they maybe aren't able to attend the group anymore. Or we even have a group for people whose loved one has passed away. So, you know, there are overall more family members coming, but we have on any given, we meet once a month, at any meeting, we can have around 30 or so people with Alzheimer's there. And, you know, and we have the groups that we run for them. We have two groups that are very much a typical support group, sitting and talking about what is their experience and what is life like with Alzheimer's disease. Given that sometimes for people with Alzheimer's, coming up with the words they want to say can be difficult, or having sometimes insight into the experience isn't always there either, or is there in degrees. We also have, and we've had since the very beginning, a music therapist who runs one of the groups for people with Alzheimer's, and she's great. And so she can come at it from a different perspective, and it's not as formal a group, and they use music and play instruments and sing, but still have conversation. So we're able to have people who maybe don't have as much insight into the experience, or people who are farther into the process, or we just have people who like music better. We have one gentleman right now who plays guitar, and every meeting he brings his own guitar and plays with our music therapist, even though he has Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it true that diagnosis of younger onset Alzheimer's is a little bit difficult? I mean, people wouldn't expect at that young age to be developing that disease.
Right. It is more difficult in most cases. In some group or some families with young onset, it's a genetic form, and so it runs in the family, and it's very obvious that, you know, multiple people are getting it in different generations. So it's easier to diagnose in those cases. Mm-hmm. But in most people, it's just this, it's something, you know, it's just something that happens. And so it does, when you're thinking of someone in their 40s or 50s or early 60s, you're not thinking Alzheimer's. And so what we hear is a lot of times they have to go to multiple doctors that, you know, they will often say, well, maybe it's depression or maybe it's stress, or a lot of times for women, they'll say, well, maybe it's menopause is causing this. And so it often takes multiple doctor visits to be able to then say it's Alzheimer's disease.
So it's really not easy to diagnose in the early stages of the disease.
It's not. And especially when you're dealing with someone who's young, you don't want to say it's Alzheimer's right away. You want to make sure you're ruling everything else out and you know, saying that before you come up with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's.
In addition to attending the support group, what are the most effective strategies for supporting families who are dealing with this disability?
Right. I think, you know, having the family, it takes a while to fully understand what's happening for the person. And for each individual going through this, they can have a completely different response emotionally and what abilities they're able to maintain and how long. So I think it's a really tough balancing act for families to figure out. You want to keep the person as independent as possible for as long as possible, but to figure out, what do I need to start doing for that person?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an easy thing to figure out. And it causes a lot of, I'd say, stress among family members. It causes stress. I hear people with Alzheimer's say that they feel like the minute they got the diagnosis, they lost power within the family, that they were no longer the same or treated the same. And they're no longer the same spouse or the same parent. And that's hard. But from the perspective of the family, you can see why that happens too, because they're trying to figure out how to make this all work. And so they're trying to figure out, what do I need to be doing now to help this person out? What's often hard with young onset is the person can still be working when the diagnosis, you know, when they're starting to develop problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really tough exit for a lot of people, because you're right at the stride of your career and you're thinking, I'm going to be doing this for another 10, 15 years, and then work abruptly ends often. In some cases, our people have left work in a really supported, dignified way, and sometimes they've had to leave work, and it's been painful. And you know, we've had people escorted out of the building by security because they were told they couldn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a rough way to end a career.
Absolutely. Well, Ian, you brought up an important point just a few minutes ago, and that's, you know, people who have children. You know, how do you support children who are going through a parent developing Alzheimer's?
You know, it's been, in the years we've had the Without Warning group going, we've had a group for the young children. We also have a group for the adult children, too. And, you know, I just think as a child, when you're very young, you know, first grade through high school has been our group for the kids, you don't expect to have a parent with Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as a young adult, you don't expect, when you're thinking about sort of moving on and developing your own life and your own career and your own family, you don't also expect to be a caregiver at that age. And so we sure see these children at whatever age having to figure out, what is their role now, and how do they handle all of this? And we sure see high levels of stress. We can see high levels of depression in some of the kids and adult kids. We see also people who become amazing at helping others because they've had to learn to do this at a very young age.
So where can people get more information about your group and about younger onset Alzheimer'sism?
Sure. We have a website that actually has a lot of information and video clips from our group members about the experience and about the group. I know for, you know, a lot of people, they're not within the Chicago area, not able to come to the group, but there's a lot of clips on that website, and it's without-warning.net will get you to the group page. And then you can, there's quite a few pages within that. We're also in the process of making a documentary, which we're hoping will air next year on a national PBS level. And our goal is to help educate people about what is the experience and what are the communities of support that need to be around people as they go through this whole journey. So we're hoping that we'll reach out to people also who aren't able to find a support group in their local area.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I wish we'd had more time, but
no problem.
We will certainly put information on our website, and the recording of this interview will go on the website as well. So thank you, Susan Frick of Rush Hospital and the Early Warning Support Group.
Thank you.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week.